Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is its fourth series. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We welcome your feedback. My guest this week is Alison Stone, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Lancaster. I met Alison over 20 years ago when I taught at the University of Lancaster Law School, and I contacted her recently as I was preparing a course I am teaching this term on law, nature, and planetary justice, and I was interested in her recommendations on philosophical texts regarding nature. Alison is a prolific author. Her first book, Petrified Intelligence, Nature in Hegel's Philosophy, has been followed by books on Luce Irigaray and her philosophy of sexual difference, books on feminism, psychoanalysis, and maternal subjectivity, popular music and post-Kantian aesthetics, nature, ethics, and gender in German Romanticism and Idealism. And most recently, I found out that she has written a book on Frances Power Cobb, a 19th century feminist philosopher. Now, I had not heard of Cobb until Alison mentioned her own recent book to me. And then it turned out that Frances Power Cobb was a prolific writer of the mid to late 19th century, a passionate activist for the welfare of animals in particular. Cobb was also an effective law reformer, working to pass the Cruelty to Animals Act in 1876 and extremely engaged with the emancipation of women, helping to pass the Matrimonial Causes Acts in 1878. As a philosopher, she was compared to John Stuart Mill in her day and was an interlocutor with Charles Darwin and other leading intellectuals of the latter part of the 19th century. But apart from this interesting intellectual history, why should we be interested in her philosophy and thinking today? At a time of climate catastrophe, there is an urgent need to revisit the moral and legal status of non-human animals. In a forthcoming episode of Countersign, we'll be taking a close look at Dinesh Wadiwal's recent books, The War on Animals and Animals and Capital, and we will treat the use of animals as food. But it is important to note that these debates on the status of animals go back to the 19th century and no doubt much earlier in the history of philosophy. And vivisection, or the scientific experimentation on animals, is legally regulated in various jurisdictions. In the UK, the experimentation on animals is regulated by the Animals Scientific Procedures Act 1986, and accompanying regulations that are overseen by the Home Office. Under the legislation, vertebrate animals other than humans, as well as cephalopods, including in their fetal, larval, and embryonic form, are designated so-called protected animals for the purposes of the legislation. Such protected animals can be subjected to scientific experimentation, provided a license is obtained first. Georgina Sturge has compiled a really useful House of Commons study called Animal Experimentation Statistics in 2023. She indicates, and I quote, "In 2022, there were 2.7 million completed procedures involving living animals in Britain. These were regulated procedures, meaning they involved animals for an experimental or other scientific purpose or for breeding genetically altered animals." The philosophical and juridical question that arises in this context is what validates this dominion over non-human animals that these kinds of laws and statistics evidence. In addition to vivisection, or the scientific experiments conducted on animals, we also know that billions of animals are brought into existence every year solely for the purpose of being consumed by humans. How is the relative worth of animals to humans to be judged? What is the moral status of animals? What duties do humans owe to other animal species? And what is their philosophical foundations? These are the kinds of questions that Frances Power Cobb addressed in her philosophical works, and it is the subject of my conversation with Alison Stone. In our discussion, we unpack the Kantian origins of Frances Power Cobb's philosophy, her attempt to reconcile her Christian faith with Kantian notions of reason, her row with Charles Darwin regarding the nature of sympathy, and ultimately the relationship between culture and norms. At a time when morals, ethics, and norms can no longer, it seems, rest on a transcendent source, how will we make decisions about the moral or juridical status of animals? How will we avoid making simply utilitarian judgments? These are the questions that I explore with Alison Stone. Professor Alison Stone, welcome to Countersign. I'm really glad that you're able to join me on the podcast. You've written a book recently on the 19th century feminist Frances Power Cobb. And her work was intensely focused on both the emancipation of women, but also the plight of animals in the context of vivisection or so-called scientific experimentation on animals. And that was a concern about the suffering of animals, and that is a substantive concern for us today as well. But in the context of climate destruction and ecological catastrophes, the status of animals is also a concern for us. So that is one reason why I'm extremely interested in talking to you about this book. So I thought we'd begin by how Frances Power Cobb emerges as a person of interest to you.
Yeah, and thank you very much for inviting me onto the podcast. Well, as you've just conveyed, one of my ongoing interests for quite a long time has been 19th century philosophy, and yet for a long time more with canonical 19th century figures like Hegel. And a few years ago, I learnt almost by chance that a friend of mine was working on women in 19th century German philosophy. She just mentioned it. And I immediately thought, oh yes, I wonder who the women philosophers were. And I just realised that I'd never really wondered, I'd never asked really who the 19th century women philosophers were. It was just something I'd not thought about. So it was just one of those moments when you suddenly realise that you've been working on something for all this time, and yet there's a kind of key question that you've never really asked. And so that sent me looking into, in fact, women in 19th century philosophy more generally. And then I quite quickly realised, you know, that there were huge numbers of women involved at the time. So then I decided to focus on Britain. And I started off looking into it by looking at 19th century feminists, first wave feminists, because that's something that's been studied quite extensively already. And so that led me quite quickly to Cobb, because she was one of the leading feminists in Britain at the time. And then having discovered Cobb, I then discovered that she'd done all this philosophical work on other topics as well. So that was how Cobb emerged.
Great. And Cobb is someone who was born in 1822 and died in 1904. She hails from a Protestant landed family in Ireland. And as you say, was an extremely influential feminist in the 19th century. What specifically about her work and life first captured your attention?
Oh, I think the thing that first captured my attention above all was when I was reading a book called Victorian Feminists by Barbara Kane, and she mentions that Cobb saw herself as the philosopher of the women's movement. So that sort of made my ears prick up. But then when I began to look into Cobb, I mean, really, partly I was just astonished that, I mean, she published so much. So she started off publishing this book, The Essay on Intuitive Morals, in the 1850s, which was, you know, it's quite a big book in itself. And then she went on to publish dozens and dozens of journal articles. I mean, probably to put it in the hundreds would be more accurate. And in a way, it was just astonishing to me that there was this woman who'd written and published so much, and yet no one really talks about any of it, including feminist philosophers and people who are interested in women in the history of philosophy. They haven't really looked at this period at all. The place where you will find Cobb mentioned the most, not surprisingly, is in histories of animal welfare campaigning and histories of the movement against animal experimentation. So that's where she will most often be mentioned, but much more as an activist rather than a theorist.
Mm. So these are these two very interesting strands of about Cobb. So first, she's compared to John Stuart Mill and was indeed, in dialogue with him. And he would certainly, in the earlier period, in the mid-19th century, be writing positive reviews of her work and was directly engaged with her. She was an interlocutor of Charles Darwin, and we'll come to that in our conversation. So she moved in those rarefied intellectual circles, very much a privileged woman. She lived the latter 30 years of her life with another woman. So she was also, you know, in a relationship with another woman, openly hosting people at her home, etc. And on the other side, there was this deep engagement with the status of animals. She founded the Victoria Street Society in 1875 and the British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection in 1898. Now, both of these organizations, which are, you know, sort of flagship organizations in relation to animal suffering and campaigning on issues of vivisection, the Victoria Street Society is now called the National Anti-Vivisection Society, and the British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection is called the Society, is called Cruelty Free International. So she was engaged on both these fronts, both at a philosophical level and at the level of practical law reform and campaigning. But something you've alluded to already is the fact that she was a prolific essayist. And the fact she was a prolific essayist is connected to 19th century print culture. I wanted you to say a little bit about that, because part of what facilitated women like Cobb, but also other women, to engage in intellectual and public life was this rich environment of journals and periodicals.
Yeah, absolutely. It was such a feature of the culture. And when we, I mean, maybe I should mention, when we think of Cobb's the date when she lived, 1822 to 1904, you know, she coincides almost exactly with the Victorian period. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. she is in many ways a kind of a really emblematic kind of Victorian thing. But yeah, I mean, it was a period when, because of the Industrial Revolution, because of steam power, there was this vast explosion in the number of books and the number of journals and their distribution and availability and so on. So there's estimated to have been 125,000 journals and magazines and newspapers that came and went over the whole period. And Wilkie Collins called it the age of periodicals.
Mm-hmm.
These periodicals were sort of such a distinctive thing because they weren't yet specialist. So they mm-hmm. had contributions from people from what we would now see as lots of different disciplines all talking to one another. And it was quite fast-paced in a way, I think, you know, that can be quite surprising to us now when the pace of many things seems to have got really slow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but like a journal might come out, you know, 1 week's edition, and then you would have somebody writing a response to someone else that then appeared sort of the very next week.
Mm-hmm.
Even though these were, you know, substantial sort of, you know, essays, 10,000 words or so. So it sort of moved very fast, and it could get, you know, it could get quite heated. So, in some ways it has parallels now with the world of social media, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so this culture, it basically created an opening for women because they weren't sort of prohibited in any way from publishing. And so many professional avenues were closed to them at the time, like law or medicine or the church. But this was not closed. So women contributed quite a lot to the journals. And one of the other features of the culture that helped women to be able to take part as well was the fact that it was normal up until the later 1860s and sometimes right through the century, it was normal for non-fiction in journals to be anonymous,
mm-hmm.
or people might use pseudonyms or initials. And so, of course, that meant that there was no reason for editors to block a contribution from women because nobody was going to know who had authored the piece anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Although, of course, there was also the kind of informal, you know, people did sort of know who had written what a lot of the time, and or, you know, they speculated about mm-hmm. it and so on. But at least, you know, on the page, there was no indication that something was by a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although the final thing I should say about this is that Cobb was something of an exception because she signed almost everything, which I think sort of reflects how much, you know, that she was at the time sort of up there with Darwin and Mill and so on. Mm-hmm. So she mm-hmm. could afford to use her name.
Yes. I think the comparison you're making with social media today and the putative freedom, let's say, that people sort of assume that, you know, everyone has access to these platforms and they can put their opinion out there. And there was this vibrant print culture in the 19th century. But of course, what these periodicals and journals represented, distinct from the kind of media public engagement today, is that there was a sort of curating of the opinions and publications. And in that sense, the truth procedures, if you like, were maintained within certain editorial boundaries. And I think that's one of the crises we're facing today, particularly in relation to when we're discussing extremely emotive or controversial subjects, such as the rights of animals or climate change and other political issues. So I think that comparison and looking back to that period is really important because there were there were these kinds of procedures. And of course, criticisms can be made of that, that, you know, they were open to certain classes of people and not others and so on. But that was certainly a feature. Now, getting to the philosophical specificities of Cobb's work, in her philosophical works, she was a moral theorist, and there was a deep suspicion she had of utilitarianism, and her moral theory involved a articulation of how duties could be generated, how duties come to exist. What was her moral theory?
Well, it was quite heavily influenced by Kant. So she would have said that Kant was her biggest philosophical influence, even though there are some differences. So she thought that to have moral obligations, there must be a moral law imposing them on us, and a law requires a lawgiver.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawgiver for her had to be God. It had to be an absolute agency, because you might have the idea, and this would be more how people now tend to read Kant, as saying that we legislate mm-hmm. to ourselves. And she thought it can't be us doing the legislating, otherwise we'd kind of keep changing the law to suit our own interests. So she thought it had to be imposed from an outside, a transcendent source. And so this has the consequence that for Cobb, morality requires religion. She thought, in fact, it required religion both in general, but also ideally Christianity in particular. So her moral theory was therefore religious through and through. And this is one of the ways that she's an emblematic Victorian, I would say, because they were, you know, it was a very devout period in Britain, particularly.
Mm-hmm. That's important and interesting because, as you say, Kantian moral theory strongly sits with a self-legislating autonomous figure that can use reason to derive a priori principles. Now, I would contrast Cobb to Kant by saying, well, she's a sort of heteronomous thinker in that the legislation that is necessary has to come from another place. Indeed, it has to come from a Christian God. Is that a helpful contrast?
I think it is a helpful contrast. I mean, she herself talks about how duties can only apply to rational free agents, which is basically to say autonomous beings. But by comparison with Kant, yeah, it does seem that at the same time she thinks what we're obligated to do does come to us from outside, from God. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. And the other contrast, of course, quite importantly, on the subject of vivisection, is that she's different to Kant on the status of animals, even though, you know, she was concerned with the suffering of animals in terms of vivisection or scientific experimentation and other brutalizations of animals, but not so far as vegetarianism or the use of animals for food. So it was the kind of gratuitous suffering, if you like, but still a strong distinction here with Kant, who, you know, placed animals hierarchically below humans. You know, he recognized them as sentient beings, but that was it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, he thinks that we should be kind to animals, but it's because if we treat animals cruelly, then we'll end up being cruel to human beings. And mm-hmm. Cobb did refer to this as a tremendous error. So mm-hmm. even though she was influenced by Kant, she was quite happy to criticise him. And she thought that, I mean, she did think, at least in her earlier work, she shifted on this over time, but in her earlier work, she did think that because we are irrational moral agents, that we stand higher than animals. And so sort of other things being equal, as it were, we should prioritise other humans over animals. But she thought that still left space for us to have duties to animals to make them as happy as we can and reduce their suffering as much as we can. And those are duties to the animals, not just sort of indirect duties mm-hmm. to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so treating animals well was not a sort of pedagogic exercise for treating humans better, as Kant would have it. But just on the other difference, how did her reliance on religion as the ground of law, as it were, compare to Kant? Because he too was thinking about religion sort of within the bounds of reason. Was that something that you found her engaging with?
Yeah. So, I mean, another part of his thought that had a huge influence on her is that he suggests that we have to believe in an afterlife, and we have to believe in a kind of unending sort of moral progression in the afterlife to a point where happiness and virtue will be proportioned. And he thought without that hope, we would lose motivation to be moral. And Cobb follows him sort of absolutely on that. So she also insists that there has to be immortality and there has to be this sort of process of infinite making ourselves more and more perfect. Otherwise we would fall into despair and seeing, the world around us in which happiness and virtue aren't proportioned at all. So that was certainly something that she took from him.
Mm-hmm. The other sort of dominant philosophical orientations of her time that she was also engaging with, of course, was Jeremy Bentham's utilitarianism. And the kind of ethics that arise out of utilitarianism. And of course, in contemporary times, one of the most influential philosophers on animal rights, but a whole range of other issues, is Peter Singer, who, in the mid-1970s published extremely influential books in relation to animals, but very strongly, in fact, the sort of epitome of a utilitarian philosopher. So Cobb had no truck with utilitarianism. Is that right?
No, that's right. Although, I mean, actually she does have a little bit of truck. So she recognised that Bentham had said that animals should be morally considered because they can suffer, because they have feelings. And so she did say, Bentham was right on that point. But, generally, she was very anti-utilitarian. Because she understood it to be a theory that took its starting point as being the empirical fact that people do desire their own happiness. And then from there said, since this is what people do desire, we ought to pursue the general happiness. So that was the way she understood utilitarianism. And she then thought that because it had that starting point in everyone desiring their own happiness, that it entailed that everyone would ultimately be selfish. So that even though utilitarians said there was the duty to bring about the greatest happiness of the greatest number, she thought that couldn't really be justified within utilitarianism, that it was bound to sort of degenerate into just kind of all-round selfishness.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, there are terms in your book that I actually hadn't come across before, so I should mention them. Euthymism, and private eudaimonism and public eudaimonism. Do you want to say a little bit about those terms?
So, yes, absolutely. I mean, so this is in her her book, in the Essay on Intuitive Morals, and this is the part of it where she's criticizing what she thinks are the wrong moral theories. And so euthumism, as she puts it, people generally talk about as virtue ethics. And she rejects it because she thinks that it's the view that the reason to do good is for the sake of your own character and having a virtuous character and feeling happy to be virtuous, which she thought was... She was always concerned that we should be benevolent to others. She always talks in terms of benevolence, that we should be benevolent to others for their sake and not our own sake in any form. And with public and private eudaimonism, and this is her categorization of the different kinds of utilitarianism. So Benthamite utilitarianism, as promoting the greatest happiness of the greatest number, that's what she calls public eudaimonism. Mm-hmm. Whereas the private one is simply pursuing your own interest. But she thinks that the public one will always collapse back into the private one.
Now that's really useful and helpful also for kind of engaging current utilitarian arguments. And the other sort of strand in this course of discussion is her response to intuition or intuitionism. I mean, what was her sort of advance in relation to that?
Well, so she thinks that our fundamental duties, that we know them intuitively, and what she ultimately means by that is that, well, actually, there's sort of two things that she ultimately means by that. So one is that she thinks we don't know our duties by deriving them from any kind of empirical facts about the world. So this is also related to the anti-utilitarianism. Mm-hmm.
So it's not an inductive form of reasoning.
It's not inductive, no. So she says these are a priori intuitions that we have independently of any empirical input. Mm-hmm. But there's also the thought that we have these intuitions basically because God has given them to us in order to make sure that we have the moral knowledge to act on the duties that he's legislated mm-hmm. for. Mm-hmm. She has to have, so that in a way, intuition is also her sort of one of her ways of connecting us with God and sort of making sure that there is a way for him to kind of give us knowledge of what it is that we've got to do morally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I was just going to say one other thing about utilitarianism, yes. though, is that even though she completely rejects it, she does also think that we have that one of our fundamental duties is to promote the happiness and reduce the suffering of all sentient beings. Mm-hmm. So it's actually very similar.
Yes. yes, very similar, yes, to utilitarians. Yeah. But the philosophical grounding is distinct. And I think terms of where one then goes in terms of law reform or, you know, practical responses, you go in quite different directions, I think, depending on which of these strands you're coming from. And we'll probably get to that further in our conversation. Now, she takes this philosophical orientation, her grounding of a moral theory, and applies it to two categories of being. One is women and the other is animals. In fact, she speaks of the torture of wives, just as vivisection involves a kind of torture of animals. And she's then influential in the passing of the Cruelty to Animals Act, 1876, and indeed also the Matrimonial Causes Act of 1878. So this places a lot of faith in the state and in legislation. So how does this practical, pragmatic side of Cobb sit with her religious-based moral theory, particularly, well, I was going to say particularly in relation to women, because we're also talking about a sort of Victorian social milieu, Victorian gender values, which were, of course, by the 1860s and 70s, highly contested by various feminists. So she's part of that milieu and movement. But I'm interested to see how the philosophical ideas gets transferred into law reform.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great question. I think that the connection really is simply through the concept of law itself, because she thinks of morality in terms of a moral law, so that in a way it quite naturally lends itself to the thought, let's have the positive law sort of reflect kind of the natural moral law, if you like. So I think that's sort of how she goes from an ethics that's focused on the moral law to thinking that the law is sort of one of the central things that needs to be reformed. I mean, she always had this pessimistic strand to her of sort of thinking of human beings as prone to just pursue their own self-interest. She thought we are capable of following the moral law, and we do have these intuitions that tell us about it, but still we're liable to fall into self-interest. And so if we can use positive law to kind of help make sure that people do act on the moral law, then so much the better for her. But I mean, absolutely, she does have faith in law and the state, although, you know, she began to get more jaded about it towards the very end of her life. But yes, basically she did. And she certainly didn't seem to see the state or law as being an instrument of kind of the patriarchy or of the bourgeoisie or anything like that. It seems to have been much more that she thought there were some good actors within Parliament and within the establishment generally, and let's try and get them on side and get them behind reforms. This is one of the more conservative strands of COP, that sense of let's sort of work with the institutions and sort of the best people within them, rather than, you know, it was very different, you know, from the somewhat later suffragette idea of kind of direct action and, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Although in that sense, not all that different to law reformers today who, you know, will tackle extremely vexed questions. For example, in relation to climate, you know, we've got Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion, etc., taking various kinds of direct action. And at the same time, other groups that will try to engage progressive elements within Parliament, within institutions, within the judiciary, to bring about law reform. So those strands are, you know, haven't left us in a sense. I'm conscious here that her let's say more conservative orientation was also what led her to perhaps fall out with people like Annie Besant and other women who were moving away or making a different spiritual journey away from Christianity towards agnosticism or atheism as the 19th century progressed. And Cobb most certainly did not. And, you know, why not, given your reading of her, your extensive reading of her work? And what are the implications of that for her moral theory?
I mean, I think she really couldn't see how you could have morality without religion, because of her initial moral theory, because religion, because Christianity was woven through it, you know, that you had to have a divine legislator and you had to have these intuitions sort of telling us what God intended us to do. And so she thought that abandoning religion was bound to just kind of erode morality altogether. I mean, it is another of the more conservative sides of her, this worry that without religion we'll lose moral distinctions, we'll lose sort of moral landmarks. And she did acknowledge that there were agnostics and atheists who seemed to be very moral people, morally praiseworthy people, so like George Eliot was one of her examples. But she thought that they were only moral because they had been shaped by Christianity, even though they had since rejected it. And she thought that if we got to a social world that was really sort of consistently atheist, which she thought might well take about 1,000 years, in that situation, she thought there would be no morality left at all. Mm-hmm. So she thought that a lot of atheists and agnostics around her, I mean, she thought they were kind of self-deceived, I guess, that they didn't realise how much they were still taking from Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, on the one hand, there's this hugely conservative dimension where there's a sort of linear progressive idea about one's moral condition that is linked to Christianity. And of course, it's entirely consistent with empire. So this was also the civilizing mission, the white man's burden. And as the Sri Lankan feminist Kumari Jayawardena has written a book called The White Woman's Other Burden, which was actually where I first came across Annie Besant, because there were many women who were practicing theosophy who went to India and were very much part of this expansion of Victorian society to the colonies. So there's a sort of progressive civilizational idea that is in Cobb's work. But on the other hand, there is the, I think, quite fundamental question lodged in there about whether ethics and morality can exist without authority from outside, whatever that outside is. Now, we may not call that outside God. We might call that outside a whole range of affective influences, affects, if you like. But yeah, I thought, I mean, I think we can come back to that question at the end as well. But I wondered whether those, that sort of structurally, that's what's going on. That there's both the sort of teleological Christian dimension, and then there's also this structural place of authority within moral thinking.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very good way of putting it. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And I do think that captures really well some of what is interesting in terms of her argument about morality. But absolutely. I mean, she did, as I say, she thought that morality needed religion, and that needn't be the Christian religion, but still she thought that the Christian religion was what supported morality sort of most comprehensively, and she kind of judged the other world religions as sort of, you know, they supported morality too to an extent. Mm-hmm. but not as well. So as you say, in that way her thought did align with imperialism, absolutely. And I mean, there's been an interesting argument as well. Another person who uses that phrase about the white woman's burden, Antoinette Burton, talks about it, suggesting that with Victorian feminism, that in a way the whole project of sort of trying to get women involved in government and to have a say in government was in a way necessarily to want to be part of imperial government, because that was what the British government was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, yes.
And, you know, you could certainly apply that to Cobb as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, well, the post-colonial theorist in me always goes back to the phrase, the British learn to govern themselves by governing others, and that the whole task of imperial governance was also how British institutions developed. Now, Cobb is you know, sort of multifaceted in her influences. And she really tries to harmonize the science of her day with religion. So in encountering Charles Darwin, for example, and the theory of evolution, she was not someone who therefore sought to dismiss Darwin's theory. In fact, she tried to incorporate it into her moral theory. So Darwin's The Origin of the Species is published in 1859. And Darwin becomes someone who's in conversation with Cobb. He's an interlocutor. And in fact, he sends her, she's only one of three people, I think I read in your book, that he sent a draft of The Descent of Man, which was published in 1871. And of course, she promptly sends a rather harsh review of it, and that causes them to fall out. So there is a real attempt to incorporate the scientific advances of her day and make it consistent with this religious-based moral theory. I mean, how does she go about doing that?
Well, the way that she tried to do it, it was actually the moves she made here were quite common to a lot of Victorian respondents to Darwin. So it was to say that his accounts, she's completely convinced by it as an account of how the different species have come into being, and indeed how human beings as physical creatures have come into being. But she also then says that God has set this whole process going. So evolution is the way that God's plan has been brought about. And part of that plan is that God intended us to develop the kinds of bodies that allow us to also be rational, moral agents. So she kind of takes the idea of God's plan and combines it with the idea of evolution through natural selection. At first, that was what she thought. And as I say, this was quite a popular move. So it was a way of kind of taking Darwin's theory, but saying it didn't need to undermine Christianity. And I guess we've since come largely to think that, in fact, the theory of evolution, you know, was sort of a disaster for Christianity. And I guess over time it has been. Mm-hmm. But in the 1860s, the main line of response was this sort of great effort to reconcile the two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Darwin himself, of course, was not throwing Christianity out the window. He was a creature of his times and was trying to sustain the consistency of evolution and Christian notions. So one of the specific points on which Cobb and Darwin disagreed was around the development of emotions. And this the development of emotions, and particularly sympathy, was central to Cobb, and Darwin was also trying to respond to this. So particularly the notion of heteropathy being the pleasure one takes in someone else's pain, or the pain one suffers because of someone else's pleasure. So now that's something that appears to be innate in humans, at least, being around my six-year-old and her friends, I can certainly see the nature of heteropathy in operation. But this was a kind of frontier of disagreement for Darwin and Cobb.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that you can see it at work in your daughter and her friends, because one of Cobb's several of Cobb's examples of heteropathy and how innate it is are drawn from children, because, you know, she's very much sort of got that view that if we want to know about the innate nature of human beings, we need to look at children and we need to look at sort of so-called primitive tribes,
mm-hmm.
and see what happens there. So, yeah, she thought that we all start off with heteropathy and we only learn to be sympathetic to one another gradually,
mm-hmm.
Under the influence, again, for her, primarily of religion. I mean, other cultural influences too, but particularly religion. So, but the fact that she'd come to put more weight on sympathy, that was something that she took from Darwin, because in The Descent of Man, he also makes sympathy sort of the central moral emotion. But he thought that we can explain in evolutionary terms sort of why we are sympathetic to one another, or at least why we've come to be sympathetic to one another, so that we don't need to appeal to religion to make mm-hmm. sense of it. We can make sense of it on a natural basis. And Cobb objected to that. So not surprisingly. And she, in fact, agreed more to a point with Herbert Spencer. So Herbert Spencer was the one who coined the phrase the survival of the fittest for mm-hmm. talking about evolutionary theory. And Cobb thought that was kind of the right description,
mm-hmm.
that from nature and from the sort of evolutionary struggle over scarce resources, the only thing it would give us by nature is feelings of competition and aggression and, in fact, heteropathy, sort of wanting to be doing better than others. So that she thought there still needed to be some non-natural agency that could kind of overcome these impulses and mm-hmm. and lead us to become more sympathetic. And so that non-natural agency, of course, being God.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we can see how it's another of these things, as you put it earlier, where she's wanting to appeal to an authority kind of outside. But and again, I think, you know, in some ways it's conservative. But then there's also this sort of quite interesting thing going on where she's sort of saying, look at these sort of terrible forces of competition and aggression and cruelty and brutality that she could really see being unleashed around her. And she was sort of looking for some kind of source
mm-hmm.
that can motivate us to do better.
Mm-hmm.
And that source for her sort of had to be outside.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in a sense, the phrase the survival of the fittest or competition or the human domination of everything that is not human, whether that is other forms of life or non-life, is at the crux of so many discussions around climate change and ecology, indeed the suffering of animals, whether for scientific experiments or for consumption as food. So, you know, she was really trying to tackle the nub of that question. And of course, placing the authority for that outside, or as I previously characterized, in a sort of heteronomous structural location. Now, she disagreed with a contemporary of hers, Anna Kingsford, on vegetarianism, and she was fine with animals being slaughtered for food. I mean, do you get a sense of how that is reconcilable with her position on vivisection? Because the suffering of animals in the process of them being used as food, you know, it's easy for humans living today to be blind to that, because meat appears on supermarket shelves and we don't, for the most part, see the process of production or the process of rearing and killing of animals. But that would have been closer to her, I would have thought, in the 19th century. What's the reason for this blind spot?
I mean, that's a very good point, actually, about the difference, you know, now that we don't sort of see how it's come about. I think, though, that, and that's something that Anna Kingsford raises, and so does Annie Besant after mm-hmm. she's become a theosophist and a vegetarian. And they both sort of say, you know, people should be forced to kill their own meat. And, you know, mm-hmm. let's see if the sort of nice, refined lady who's happy to eat some rabbit will feel just as happy about it if she has to go out and kill the rabbit herself. But yeah, in terms of Cobb, she basically thought that if the animal was given a humane life and then was killed painlessly, that was okay. She actually described this as being, in her phrase, compatible with the widest benevolence. And yet the puzzling thing is that she came to think that animal experimentation was wrong, even if it was done with anaesthetics. And you might think the two cases look similar. I mean, I think some of it as well, of course, she was writing before factory farming. So mm-hmm. although it would have been more normal to see animals, you know, being killed at the butchers and so on. But mm-hmm. I guess at the same time, you would see, you know, many farm animals having what seemed a kind of decent life. And I think the other factor was that she really believed that we couldn't manage on a vegetarian diet, mm-hmm. that we'd be sacrificing our health. And I think she thought, and possibly even our lives. Mm-hmm. So I think she thought that would be sort of over demanding. So there's several factors, but I think still we'd have to say, on the whole, it's a very odd fit to be so absolutely against animal experimentation, mm-hmm. and yet also, you know, not have any misgivings at all about endorsing, you know, the farming of animals for meat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. Just one, well, there's a couple of final questions as we come to time. I really like the discussion towards the end of your book about why Cobb might have been forgotten, including by feminists. And part of the account you give is that this is to do with the emergence of professions and experts and away from the sorts of generalists who are engaged in these debates in the various periodicals we were talking about at the outset. And in that sense, there was a very different way in which intellectuals were engaging the public. Now, you know, there is the notion of the public intellectual today. I'm afraid a lot of the public intellectuals seem to publish books that are also what I would call sort of throwaway books. You know, they've got sexy titles and they hit the shelves and they're around for about 6 months.
How to do something or other.
Yes, there's those sorts of things. But even I think on sort of in the area of more radical politics, there is this kind of sense of the throwaway book. Whereas, you know, there was that kind of the ferment and the fervor of debates in the periodicals is one thing I think that we've lost. And secondly, of course, we're dominated by circumscribed disciplines, you know, bounded disciplines, the professionalization of experts. So that's one set of reasons. I mean, well, yeah, what's your reflection on the forgetting of Cobb? And of course, we should note here that, you know, falling out with Darwin and other, you know, sort of major figures in of her time may not have helped either.
No, I don't think it did help. I mean, because they became enemies, really. And mm-hmm. likewise, she did with a lot of, you know, leading figures, especially scientists. I mean, I think that, yeah, there was this big change at the end of the 19th century where the academic disciplines began to become a lot more specialised, and it became much more the case that if you were going to say something serious on a topic, that you needed to be at a university, working at a university. That, you know, that hadn't really, mm-hmm. I mean, more, if we look to around the middle of the 19th century, you know, universities would be quite seen as backwaters in a way. And, you know, you might much more think it was somebody who was writing regularly in the journals who would be sort of seen as a central figure. And that shifted. And it, I mean, it, of course, it presented a big problem for women, because although universities were gradually opening up to them, then they were still largely excluded. So, you know, that bore on Cobb, but also on quite a lot of others as well. But I think with Cobb as well, she had become so committed to anti-vivisection. I think in many people's minds, she sort of just was reduced to that, and kind of, you know, was just the leader of anti-vivisection.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a movement that was sort of against the professionalization of the disciplines, because the physiologists and medical practitioners would increasingly tend to sort of say, look, only we understand why animal experiments need to happen. You know, Louis Pasteur understands how vaccination works and, you know, why the anthrax vaccine will actually benefit animals and, you know, more than humans. And lay people don't seem to be able to understand this. So, you know, they should just sort of be quiet and leave it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And this was very much what Cobb was opposing. So really, she kind of stood on one side of things, but the sort of social and intellectual world moved in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, here we are discussing Frances Power Cobb over 200 years after her birth, very much thanks to your book, at least in my case, because I wasn't familiar with her. And my sense is that she's an extraordinary contemporary thinker, or at least the purchase of her work is very important for our current times. And part of my sense of this is that she was grappling with what Jean-Luc Nancy referred to as a crisis of sense in the context of the death of God. Now, the death of God itself is not something that she accepted. Quite the contrary, she was grounding her moral law on God. But the phrase news that God is dead did prop up in some correspondence I think I saw referred to in your book. And she was responding to this crisis by articulating a moral law in the context of that crisis. And the register in which she engaged with the problem was that of the emotions and affect. And I think that's very much a current trend in political and social theory and philosophy. So my sense is that actually she's very much a current thinker, albeit the reliance on a Christian God is not where we would place our morality and ethics. Do you think that's a fair summation?
Yeah, very fair. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and she does, she emphasized the emotions more and more over time. I mean, in a way, when she started off putting a lot of weight on intuitions, it kind of more shifts gradually sort of into the emotions and especially sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
And so she ended up in a position of saying that we need to feel the right way about animals, i.e. we need to have sympathy for them as kind of living, intelligent beings. And if we feel the right way, then we'll act the right way. Yeah, so feeling kind of, it does more and more come to sort of occupy that place of kind of providing something that can sort of withstand really the kind of world of scientific technological modernity that she saw coming in. Because, you know, I think that was a lot of what she was opposing, really, that she saw a modern industrial world coming in that appeared to be kind of pushing values out and, you know, pushing kindness out and compassion. So, she wouldn't quite have put it that way, but you know, I think that was what she was opposed to, really, a kind of value neutral, sort of totally instrumentalized world.
Great. Well, Alison Stone, I'm really grateful that you've written this book. I think it makes a wonderful contribution to the store of ideas we need to draw on as we tackle animal suffering, ecological crises of various kinds. And more broadly, I think it helps to understand the cultures in which norms are created. And I think that connection between culture and normativity is something that I will be reflecting much more on as we go forward. But I'm really grateful for you giving me your time and coming on Counterscience. So thank you so much.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. Really, you've asked some really terrific questions.
Thanks, Alison.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.